Welcome back to The Drop. This is Michael Saramella here to talk about everything that happened this week in surfing. Before we get into the news, we have a little something for our loyal podcast listeners, that is you. And for a limited time, if you sign up for Stab Premium, you will get 10% off using code DROPWALLETS. That's DROPWALLETS, plural, one word, no spaces. Go get it, go get amongst it. So, what is happening this week? Nothing really. Just Kelly Slater retiring, kind of, maybe. At least from full-time CT Star. We'll get into it. But anyway, we are going to chat with the man who wrote the greatest Kelly Slater profile in the history of Kelly Slater profiles, and there have been many, Paul Evans. And after that, Buck is going to hop on. We're going to talk about a new slash old film property that we're bringing back to life, a beautifully nostalgic piece about the Western Australian desert. And finally, we'll hear from the star of Stab's new film, Zipper, Mr. Christopher Chippa Wilson, in his Stab interview, which is not to be missed. Let's drop in.
Mikey, it's a Czech beer originally. It's from the Czech Republic, a Czech lager.
No, this is... Okay, so context. Buck and I just started recording, and he holds up to the camera a Budweiser... Budvar, otherwise known as Budvar. A Budweiser. But there's so many confusing factors going on, because as I understand it, you are in Germany right now. Is that correct?
No, incorrect. I am in the United Kingdom.
Oh, why did I think you were going to Germany? Oh, you said you were going to the Germany pool, and then I guess there's two pools now. There's one in...
I'm a pool boy. I'm a pool boy. I'm going to the Germany pool soon, but right now I'm in Bristol in the United Kingdom. My wife had to come here, and I decided to join. I said, yes, of course I will join you here in Bristol, and tomorrow I'm going to the Wave.
Okay, so you're going to the Wave tomorrow. You're in Bristol. You are drinking a Czech beer called Budweiser, which I thought was an American beer all this time.
Mikey, and look at the logo, too.
It's basically the same.
They ripped that off as well. It's red font. It's similar. The story goes, which I found years ago when I went to the Czech Republic, Prague, beautiful place. Apparently, these guys have been making beers for a very long time. Some American gents came over, tried the beers, enjoyed the beers, decided, we think Americans would like these beers as well. And so they created, they didn't just try to steal, like recreate the recipe and the taste, they just stole the whole thing, including the name and logo. And now that's Budweiser. But when you're in Europe, especially in Czech Republic, you could still find Budweisers, which are from a different, entirely different company that has been doing it for way longer. And I think they taste better. It's a delicious
lager.
Well,
I just did a tiny bit of research, and it turns out that Budweiser is an American-style pale lager, but it's a brand of Belgian company, AB InBev. So, do Belgium and the Czech Republic have beef? Like, how far does this go?
No, I think AB InBev thing is just a fucking conglomerate. I think they own, like, most everything now. I think Budweiser was its own thing that started that way, and then this AB InBev thing is just, like, the whole... The mega.
So they're like that sunglass company that owns it, or just glasses company that owns everything.
Yeah. Yeah. They are. What is it called?
AB InBev.
Oh my, it's fucking ABG. It's a complete same thing. This is, now we're back to surfing. Let's go to the news. The king is dead. Long live the goat. This was, according to our site, a 26-minute read, one that I indulged in on the plane ride over here. But I don't really feel like I'm the one to be talking about this. I believe we should get Paul Evans on the program, who wrote this. And I know you're going to talk to him, but like, how long did he take? What was behind the scenes on this? Like, how long have you guys been planning this thing? Because 26-minute reads don't come up overnight, Mikey. Michael.
There's some detail in that in the comment section of the story, if your finger has enough energy to scroll down there. I thought Paul started it after the VMAs incident in 2005, but it turned out that Paul actually did a first draft in 1998 after Kelly Slater lost at J-Bay to, who was that British guy?
Russell Winter.
Russell Winter. Yep. He lost to Russell Winter. And so Paul's been on it since then, slowly chipping away. But no, realistically, I reached out to Paul, I think, a month before the CT started this year, because my guess was that Kelly was going to surf Pipeline and then retire. So I wanted to have it ready for that moment. Of course, he didn't do that. And then I thought it might be at Sunset. Didn't do it there. Obviously, didn't go to Portugal. He went to Kira. And, you know, Bells was lackluster. Margs was his last chance, you know, just with having literally the ability to surf in a CT event, unless the WSL wants to keep giving him wild cards. So the line that we kind of went with is, yeah, he wouldn't say the word retire, right? Because I think it's like physically impossible for him. It's kind of like a forced retirement in a way. And you could tell that, you know, he's still talking about wild cards. He's still talking about snapper. But the reality is Kelly has surfed his last heat as a full-time CT surfer, unless some sort of miracle happens, which I wouldn't put out of the cards.
I really thought we found the best wording there on Instagram with that. Kelly Slater steps away from, what was it, something as full-time CT surfer. And I was like, that's true. But there was one text, like there's kind of like, when Kelly officially, when he says the word, when he says the R word, there will be a flood on Instagram. And now it's like this kind of like my, it's like a half flood. Like, I feel like half the people have went, half like, surely when he fully says it, it'll be five times this. But still, I mean, everything from a bunch from Adrian to Mick Fanning have been posting about it, but I still feel like, is that classic Kelly too, by the way, to just get like, a few hits out of this?
It actually makes me a little sad. Like when you saw him, you know, he's getting chaired up the stairs by like two guys who it sounds like are really good dudes that live in the Margaret River area. They have a podcast of their own. But they're not like, you know, like Mick claimed he was going to retire at Bells. So all of his people came around that moment. Taj claimed he was going to retire at Fiji. So they had that whole thing in Nomotu that week. You know what I mean? It was like a giant celebration. But because with Kelly, there's probably a part of him that was like, oh, what if I win Margaret's and make the cut? You know, it's not over yet. So because he hasn't been clear about it, and I think that that is probably a personal thing that he's having to deal with himself, like the moment maybe wasn't as big or as clear as he would have wanted it to be. Which leads me to think, like, yeah, maybe he will do it at Fiji. He's talked about getting a wild card there. I could see him getting a wild card into Pipe next year as well, and actually, like, properly ending it there around, like, everybody, because that's where, really, he would be around most people that, you know, he loves and cares about. So I don't think he's maybe had that specific retirement walk-off moment yet, but for all intents and purposes, he is done as a full-time CT surfer. So that's where we kind of had to draw the line. That's why we finally dropped Paul's piece, which he worked really hard on, as you can tell. To me, this is the best thing that Paul has ever written, which is a huge statement because he's written a lot of the best stuff that's ever been on Stab. It's the best profile ever done on Kelly. It's just in a league of its own, and yeah, let's get him on here to talk about it because he did a whole lot of research for this. They say nobody is bigger than any sport, but for a large chunk of history, Kelly Slater hasn't merely been bigger, but more massive, the supernova around which surfing solar system revolves, which perhaps portends what will be left in Kelly's competitive wake, a dark, all-consuming vacuum, better known as a black hole. Paul? You wrote that. Is it true? Is competitive surfing going to be in turmoil and chaos?
No. No, I'm not worried about it. I think it's going to be okay, but it's definitely going to be different. Yeah, it's it already feels a little bit different, does it? I'm not sure. This is a new future without Kelly. A couple of wild cards here and there, but yeah.
It is strange. I was talking about it with Buck, like, I don't know, the actual moment felt like not as consequential as you would have maybe expected, but only as a result of it having been this like half in, half out thing for so long. Like, it's not like this clear cut moment in history where it's like, oh, this is Kelly's last contest. Like, he's still, you know what I mean, claiming that he's going to try to get in events and stuff like that. But for if you look at the bigger picture, like, it is huge, Kelly Slater stepping away from full-time competition.
Yeah, it was. I mean, yeah, it was, is a little bit sort of sad and underwhelming that it happened at sort of slightly on she main break Margaret River. Although in a way it's also quite funny that it happened. I guess the only way it could have been really epic is if he had retired in 22 and he won Pike. That was kind of the time to sort of guarantee it was going to be a bang, and how hard that win was to come by in those ways as well, and how long it took. Kind of suggested that at the time, didn't it? But obviously he didn't feel that's the right time. But yeah, if he really wanted to go out on, you know, do that mic drop moment, I guess that would have been the one. After that, I mean, yeah, everywhere's going to seem, I mean, you know, some people thought maybe at Sunset he'd pack it in this year. That would have been, I don't know, maybe not quite as bad as Margs, but yeah, everything's, I guess, everybody's got to die sometime, haven't they? So, yeah. I mean, he's not dead, obviously. He's fine. He's in rude health. But yeah, no more.
You did say the king is dead. That is the first thing that is in the title of your entire story. So,
yeah.
Well, but no, Kelly Slater's not dead, luckily.
Yeah, just to clear that up, the king is dead, long live the king is an expression about continuity. So when the monarch dies, the announcement is the king is dead. And then the long live the king is recognizing the new king, as if to say that the monarchy is perpetual and always in charge. So I think that's what that's all about, I believe.
Well, thank you for clarifying. Yeah. I'm sure that will help out a lot of people yeah. in the comments. Yeah. And the powers that be at WordPress or whoever does our auto-generated reading times on this thing says it's also the longest piece ever written on Stab at 26 minutes reading time. So congratulations, Paul.
Yeah, thanks. That's nice of you to say. My friend told me it took him an hour, and my wife, who generally doesn't read, I think she's read one thing that I've written ever. I sort of semi-tried to make her read it the other day, and I said, "What are you doing?" And she said, "I'm skimming." And it still took her. It still took her about 40 minutes. So, yeah, that's fine. I mean,
yeah. But it's so good. It's not like there's, like, even, like, dead spots in it. Like, I was just rereading it today to get ready for this conversation, and I was just like, this is unbelievable. Like, obviously, the story, like, Kelly's just got so much history to cover. You basically skimmed over Kelly's history, and yet still it's basically a full-fledged biography. And it's just so entertaining at the same time. Like, there are so many passages in here that either I'm amazed by, you know, what the actual context is, or it's just so well written that, I don't know, if anybody who appreciates writing and anybody who appreciates surfing should really take a moment this weekend to sit down and properly read this.
Yeah, thing. I guess it's quite a long story. He had a long career. There's a couple of bits that I felt really kind of needed diving into. The sort of what happened after he first came back on tour in particular. That bit, it's not blow by blow of the 2005 season, but there was so much that went on then. I mean, as I was sort of going back and researching it through, because you sort of have memories of these things, but they get quite jumbled up. And I've got quite an extensive back catalogue of surf magazines. And then you just have loads of weird sort of false memories of things that never actually happened. So I had to try and make sure a little bit. The internet was quite sketchy back then as well. And a lot of things that happen with the old internet is things get republished it's quite boring, but when platforms change their content management system, basically. So an article that might have been written in 2004 suddenly looks like it's published in 2009. So it doesn't seem like it makes sense.
Right.
So there was a little bit of kind of detective work to make sure I kind of got it like semi-accurate. But I think most of the stuff's in order. But yeah, that 2004-2005 bit was like really, really pivotal. And just sort of fascinating when you dive back into it. Obviously, that was when he came back on tour. But the bit before then was all in print. So the 90s period, about when he first came on and when he won the five in a row. So that was all really diving into magazine archive or talking to people like Matt Walshaw from Encyclopedia Surfing. It was really, really good to help out with this. I think sometimes it's also quite good not to involve the person themselves because you get a different sort of story altogether. And I guess what I was trying to do wasn't really trying to tell it, obviously, from his perspective. It was more the perspective of the fan or the outsider or to someone watching on the impact of his career. I guess there'll be people much closer to him that can tell her, you know, from his point of view, and obviously loads of other stuff that I didn't uncover or wasn't privy to. But I did talk to Belly as well, and he's his good mate, and he told me, you know, quite a lot of interesting stuff and a few a few off the record things as well, obviously. But that was quite interesting talking to Belly, and you know, they've been mates forever. I guess they're still kind of best mates. They're not really in a work capacity anymore. But Belly was really helpful too with loads of cool stuff. And I mean, I've been sort of interested to see what's he gonna do from here. I think we're still gonna see him surfing, aren't we? I don't think it's in doubt that we're not gonna see him in a jersey again.
No, I mean, yeah, he's already calling for Fiji. He's made a rough mention of potentially surfing in the first Challenger Series event of the year. We actually have now an in-office bet running. Somebody has bet me that Kelly Slater will surf in a majority of the Challenger Series events this year, which I think is insane, but we'll see how that plays out. But yeah, getting back to your story, you brought up Belly. I thought he added a lot of great context into like the sort of interpersonal relations that Kelly had on tour. Like, it sounded like he really had a different experience on tour socially than most other surfers. Do you want to get into that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess the Belly relationship, I don't want to say they're like a married couple, but they kind of know each other so well. And it was kind of circumstances really that put them together. Belly was the team manager at Quicksilver, taking care of the global team. So he was in that kind of much more in that like pit boss role rather than coaching or anything like that as such. But at the same time, he did sort of serve in that role to a certain extent as well in terms of, you know, stuff that's going on in the heat. There was one quite sort of funny example where. Belly was supposed to signal. So Adriana D'Souza won Peniche. And I think Belly was supposed to signal if there was a set coming or which one to go. And I think he must have said there wasn't another wave coming, or yeah, he got it wrong basically. Kelly went the first one. Guess what? There was a bomb behind it. And Kelly wasn't too stoked with Belly about that. So there was some actual kind of, if that is surf coaching, some coaching stuff. But other than that, I think it's mainly about kind of managing the whole kind of show, and you know, making sure he's got in his comfortable space. I guess when you're on tour for that long, you kind of know exactly how you want to do it and who you want to have around you and how it's all going to work out. So I guess from Belly's point of view, it's about sort of facilitating that and making it happen, but also just you got to kind of know when to disappear and you know, not say too much, and when to maybe, you know, there's not too many people when you're that famous, that successful, that wealthy. There's probably not too many people telling you stuff you don't want to hear. And I guess Belly's probably quite a, you know, an honest sort of forthright kind of person in that kind of old school sort of Aussie sense. I guess he wouldn't have too many problems in telling Slater when he thought he'd fucked up or got something wrong, or you should do it differently. And I think Kelly probably appreciated that.
And then on the flip side too, Belly was his like one true supporter when it seemed like the rest of the tour was against him, right? Like, you brought up that one incident, I think, where was it? Were they in like Reunion Island or something like that, he said?
Yeah, it was at the Search CT in Saint Louis. I was there for that one actually. And a great event. I'd love to see that come back. There's even talk of that event coming back at some stage. But Belly told the story about basically everybody on tour that was following the tour. So all of the insiders were all supporting Andy. So all of the Australians were always against Kelly, and all of the Hawaiians, sorry, were for Andy. The Australians were obviously for the Australian surfers. But everyone was already backing the other person. Everyone, like fans, Kelly was a massive fan favorite with the general public, but actually in terms of tour insiders, and Belly tells a story, yeah, and that on that one particular occasion, it was a heat against Darren O'Rafferty, and everyone's cheering Raf, you know, he's doing turns and they're all going up and roaring and cheering, and then Kelly got a wave and did a turn and Belly cheers, and everyone, you know, is just like full pin drop in the surfers area, and everyone's like staring at him, and Belly's like, and I just went, what the fuck to everyone, because you know, he's like, well, I'm not even allowed to like cheer my guy, like they're all giving him stink eye for being in the corner of his like mate. So yeah, I guess it was kind of lonely, I guess, in some ways being that good. That's something I think quite a lot of people who are so far ahead of everyone else experience, that kind of that sort of loneliness and yeah, you're in your own little bubble and kind of, yeah, it's I guess that's one of the pitfalls of being the GOAT. But yeah, a lot of people from that world against him in terms of wanted someone else. I just wanted someone different to win, something else to happen. But one thing is, I turned up in this actually as a sort of going through trying to remember, because you know most of Kelly's career I've been sort of following it along, and there was definitely a thing in the early, I guess the early 2000s, I distinctly remember people kind of identified as either Slater fans or not. And that even went down to like brand loyalty with kind of clothing and even wetsuits. I don't know if this is still a thing at all, but I remember having mates who were like really liked Quicksilver. And like, I mean, they even bought Quicksilver wetsuits, believe it or not. But yeah, and they really sort of identified in that camp. And I don't know if that's something that happens anymore, but I'm pretty confident that's much more down to Kelly than anyone else on that team. And yeah, I'm not sure if that's really a thing anymore. Do people do much brand loyalty? But looking back, I think Kelly was like a huge part of the success of that brand. I did go into a little bit of stuff about Quicksilver as well, because it's sort of, yeah, I mean, it feels, what is it, 10, 11 years ago that his contract didn't renew. Which is quite a long time ago now, but at the time when he was in his full kind of pomp, I mean, it was sort of inseparable. Quicksilver was Kelly, and kind of vice versa. It certainly felt like that.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, he's just, that's the thing, when you've been around for that long as well and at such a high level, like he's obviously been through a lot of different changes, both in terms of team and management and sponsors and everything like that. Now, obviously, he pretty much owns everything that he wears and everything that he rides for and et cetera, which makes a lot of sense. That's like the smart way forward when you have such a big platform and name. We're seeing now John Florence follow in his footsteps and brother Nate kind of joining those coattails as well, which is a really cool progression. And I think, yeah, the natural way that it has to go. And yeah, that kind of brings us to what Kelly does do next. And like we said, it'll probably enjoy a smattering of competition. But beyond that, he's also going to become a father for the second time. And this time is going to be really more like the first time, if we're being honest, because his first child, Taylor, because he was so deep in the throes of competitive surfing, and because the person with whom he had the child was not his partner, he wasn't really around for as much of that. So I'm actually so excited to see Kelly in this next phase of life and taking on something that is like, he's done the most incredible things, the most challenging things in the world, but now he has to raise a human. And I'm just so fascinated to see what that looks like. I think he could be like the coolest, best dad ever, but it will take a certain rewiring of the brain, I think, because for 52 years now, he's lived as the center of his own universe to a large degree. And from what I've gathered, Paul, you're a father, you can probably speak to this. It just, things change when you have a kid that's around and that you need to be taken care of, 24/7.
Yeah, just give me one second. Can you hear my kids ollieing? I'm just going to tell them to shut up. They're ollieing their fucking skateboard. Hang on one sec.
Oh, that's very well-timed.
I'm just going to shut them up. Joey, can you not ollie? I'm recording something, mate. Or whoever it is, can you just... Yeah, don't skate. Joe, just be quiet, mate. I'm recording something, okay? So, the genius at work here. No respect. Fucking hell, this is awesome.
At least they've got good timing.
Right.
That was fucking brilliant. I was just asking you about being a father.
Yeah. I mean, I'm pretty sure he doesn't need parenting advice from me, but I tell you what, being a surf dad's not as easy as it looks. You think I'm gonna be the cool guy, I'm not gonna like shout at him. But I literally just took one of my kids for a surf and I was like, bend your fucking legs. So good luck with that, Kelly. Might be the hardest task of all.
Well, the hardest task is going to be for his kid, right? Being Kelly Slater's kid. Like, Jesus Christ, imagine the weight on that.
Yeah, true dat. But I mean, I feel like that's one part of his mega stardom. Like, for how famous he's been for so long, a lot of people, things do get weird. Particularly when you get famous quickly, and particularly when you get famous young. And that does seem to be the one thing that he's handled better than probably anyone. He does seem to have kind of remained pretty much sort of himself. I mean, even if you just, in terms of sort of outward displays of opulent wealth, you don't really see him sort of covered in bling or, you know, just doing kind of crazy sort of new money shit, do you? That doesn't seem to be part of it. He does seem to be able to handle fame pretty well. So, yeah, from that point of view, I think he'd have a pretty good handle on, keeping things kind of as at least weird as possible.
Well, that's the other thing. Like, with Kelly, like, obviously he was so dominant competitively, but you don't know what kind of person you're going to get with that. And he, on top of just being that guy, he is also the most engaging, like, surf kind of, I don't know, just personality figure as well over the years. Like, it's not just that he's really good at riding on a wave and beating other people into submission, but then he is the most, like, articulate pro surfer ever, pretty much. Like, he's super entertaining. He's always, like, he's interested in things outside of surfing, as well as incredibly interested in surfing to the point that he breaks it down to a degree that very few can. Like, he's just a really intelligent dude on top of all that, interested in a lot of different things, and that's, I think, just increased his star power, right? And it just makes him so interesting to watch and listen to. That's why his name is always coming up in some sort of conversation about, you know, whatever's going on in the world.
Yeah, he's really unique in that respect, actually. And I touched on this a little bit in the story, but Warshaw has also kind of made this point that was fairly obvious about Kelly early on. But most of, like, the all-time, like, the real true greats of surfing, they can be socially fairly awkward, and there's almost a sort of a cachet associated with that, whereas you kind of shouldn't be kind of articulate and amenable. You shouldn't be easily be able to describe surfing if you really are on that kind of another plane kind of status. It should be like, you shouldn't really like talking about it. It should be, but he's always just been like really good at talking about it. He's enjoyed talking about it. He seems to put himself in a position where he's in that spotlight, talking about like he wants to be there, and that's super unusual, and that's probably one of the most unique things about him. But we tend to think that there's something to do with just really seeing waves and being able to move a surfboard around on that level. As if you get to that stage, you shouldn't be able to sort of converse like a normal human, and that's been something that's been really, really different about him.
Yeah, agreed. All right, so as I said before, this is one of those stories that you need to carve out. Well, WordPress says 26 minutes. Paul's wife says an hour to read over the weekend. It's truly one of the pieces that I'm most proud to have on stabmag.com. So thank you again for Paul. And just to lend a little bit more credence to what Kelly Slater means to surfing on the actual competitive side, because at the end of the day, we're talking about a human, yes, but there are certain sort of statistical landmarks that he's set that I don't know will ever be surpassed. So 11 world titles, 56 CT wins, 5 world titles in a row, the youngest at 20 and oldest at 39 world champion, the oldest event winner at 49 years and 51 weeks, with 33 of his 56 wins coming after age 30. He surfed in 281 CT events, making 82 finals with a 70% win record, an 85% heat win record in finals in Australia, 77% heat win record at Chopo, 74% at Snapper, 77% at Lowers. He's won the most events at Pipeline with 8, Lower Trestles 6, Snapper Rocks 5, Chopo 5, Tavarua 4, equal most at Bells with 4, and Hossegler at 3. Kelly Slater, thank you for your service, and enjoy the rest of your life.
Ferrari Boys with Harry Bryant. This is an 18-minute film brought to you by Toby Cregan, made just for Stab, in which we learn a lot. We learn a lot about Harry Bryant's 2015 Toyota Land Cruiser. We learn not only about that car, but I'd say my biggest takeaway here was to never feed your dog Kentucky Fried Chicken. It's a very, I understand the decision. I could see myself making that decision. But after watching this, it's hard to imagine myself making that
decision. Yeah, no, it was not a PSA. And I think all dog owners have taken it on board. If you don't know what we're talking about, I recommend you go watch it. It's one of many highlights in this piece that, like you said, made by Toby Cregan. This is a series that we started back in, like, I think 2016 was maybe the first one, at least in, you know, on the, that's what it says on the internet. So it's a series about surfers and their cars. Of course, the same way that we look at Stab in the Dark is, yeah, it's about surfboards. We really see it as a way to learn more about surfers, because when they talk about something other than themselves, they reveal more of their true character. And I think that's almost more true about cars, because surfboards are only customizable to a certain degree. Like, yeah, you, if you're not a competitive surfer, you can play around with the shape. You can obviously play around with the art, etc. But I think a car is probably like the truest representation of like what matters to a person. And you learn very quickly what matters to Harry Bryant when you see his car, which is absolutely decked out to a T to traverse anything that Australia can throw at him.
Yes, yes. Including a lack of dog food and a nearby Kentucky Fried Chicken, which is not an easy battle to get through, as we learned. But it is a battle that sometimes you have to fight. Another thing I learned, you mentioned it, this is a series that's been around, that we've done for a while. In 2016, we did a Ferrari Boys with Harry Bryant, and you get to see a few little cuts from that in this. And I'd say he almost has the same haircut, it just grew. It just went longer.
In some parts.
In the last 8 years. So that was really impressive to me. I know a guy, AJW Surfboards, Adam Warden, who used to shave his head January 1st every year. And so his reasoning was that anytime he looked at a photo throughout the year, or anytime he looked at a photo of himself, he would know kind of what time of the year it was based on the length of his hair. And he did that for many years. Based on this, I feel like Harry's almost on a long form version of that. Like, he should just slowly let it keep going, just so that like he could look back towards the end of his life and just have that immediate recall of like, okay, yeah, this is where I was at then, this is what I was doing. But I did want to call that out. Anything else you found fascinating about our 2015 Toyota Land Cruiser here, Michael?
Well, just to give you a few of the specs, this thing has a truck radio on it, which like a trucker radio, which means you can get in contact with any of those big rigs on the road, which I think...
Oh, I wrote that down immediately. I wrote that down. The conversations that they would have, because you know he's on that thing. There's no fucking doubt with his personality. You know he's picking that thing up. He's not doing it just as a joke. He's talking with these people. He's talking with truck drivers.
Absolutely. He also has just, you know, pretty standard, but a cooler where he can keep, he says he keeps only hydration liquids in there. No alcohol, of course. He has a...
Protein as well.
Yep. He has a water compressor. He has his gear shift. The little ball on top of it is a spider encased in resin, which apparently scared the shit out of Craig Anderson. And probably my favorite feature of the entire car, which serves no real purpose other than potentially causing an accident, is that his center console monitor is set up to play surf films while he's driving. Like the thing where you normally like see the music and stuff like that, or it turns into your rear view, you know, camera screen when you're backing up. His is just playing surf films on it while he's driving.
If you gave this car, remember they did Pimp My Ride on MTV? If you gave this car to Exhibit and just told him like what Harry Bryant is, I don't think he'd do anything. He'd be like, dog, you're good. You got it sorted
this
already.
We watched the first draft of this in the Stab office with Toby Cregan and the rest of the guys over in Australia. And the takeaway is, one, Toby Cregan has an almost unique and innate ability to get surfers to their most like vulnerable and fun selves. Like what he was able to get out of her. I mean, Harry's already pretty animated and, you know, he's great on camera, but like Toby just lets people just be so like themselves, and it's awesome. So that was one takeaway. And the other is that this is probably the ultimate surf vehicle. Like Harry has got this thing so wired. You can see that he put a bunch of things in himself, and I don't know. It's just like, I wish I could have this car was my biggest takeaway. And then you go through this whole thing where Harry's explaining his car. It's super entertaining. 15 minutes in He's Still Going. And then you get this crazy surf section at the end, which, like, I could almost see people, like, not getting there if they're like, oh yeah, like, this is fucking epic car, but I gotta go do something else. Like, make sure you make it to the end, because there's an incredible surf section at the end of it as well.
Love the song too. Toby, obviously a musical man, great taste. I know a lot of people cried when he decided to walk away from his band, but I am happy to have him back in the editing bay.
Yeah, and I'm happy that Harry Bryant has managed to acquire a fork since the last Ferrari Boys 8 years ago. Well done, Harry.
A dispatch from the best run of swell Northwest Australia may ever see. This is our day three comp report from the 2022... 24? Did I say 22? I'm 2 years behind. I think, as I have the other date written down. Anyway, yeah, this is not a comp recap. Western Australia is not currently experiencing the best run of swell it's ever seen. And I also did say Northwest. The contest is in Southwest Australia. Beautiful vineyards there. Not beautiful lefts.
What do you mean? They surfed that, the girls surfed that little left.
I have surfed that left. Beautiful is a big word, Mikey.
So this is a story by Ben Mondi, who is, as we've talked about before, he's not from Britain, but he lived in Britain, and he is definitely, at that time, he was Britain's best surf journalist, bar none. Yeah, so.
Of all time.
And Ben is also a really good surfer, definitely the best surfing British surf journalist as well. Like, if you were to put, like, writing skills and surfing skills, he's on the max of both sides of that scale. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise.
He's very worthy of the British Surfing Hall of Fame, I feel.
So too.
More than any other person, even if they're born,
like,
there.
It's like him and Russell Winter.
Could potentially make it. Yeah, yeah. Especially those guys that, like, moved to France.
Anyway, Ben Mondi happened to be in Northwest Australia in July of 2000 when, despite there being very little in the way of forecasting, he just happened to be there for the best 3 weeks of swell that the desert has ever seen. And the reason that we know this is because a man by the name of Phil Ogden has a handwritten log that has been going for over 25 years as he has run the Red Bluff camp. And every single day in that log, he writes down the swell conditions. And we know for a fact that over this three-week period, the surf didn't drop below 6 feet on the old school West Aussie scale, which I will let you decide what that...
That's like 18-foot faces.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know where that sits in the surf line realm, but you can imagine for yourself. So that was the low bar. And then the high bar was 12 to 15 feet, which included a wave that nobody has apparently ever achieved before or since, which you're gonna have to read the story to understand it. I've never actually been up to Northwest Australia, so I like don't fully comprehend, but it sounds like it was a pretty amazing feat, maybe akin to that time that Damien Hardman rode a wave from Snapper through Kira, something along those lines.
My favorite detail is it took 5 storms to do this. When you look back, which you can do now, and see what was going on in the atmosphere in the Indian Ocean at that time, 5 storms, just back to back to back to back to back. Bam. Pretty cool. Makes me think about surf logs too. Like, how much will we learn because I don't think Phil is the only person who did something like this. Obviously, he was in a pretty cool place to do it. There's probably people who were like my dad had a surf log for a while. I don't know what kind of compelling insights you're going to pull out of a New Jersey surf log, other than that every now and then a low fucking comes up the coast. That's it. But like, imagine if that was just digital, if you had a digital version of that, the insights that you kind of extract from things like this. Makes me think about a surf log myself, and if I chose to make one, I think it would have to be digital, even though it would be so much fun to write on paper. I think digital is the way. But I think we would learn so much if somebody took the time to, like, take a 25-year surf log and digitalize it to see which months really produce the most swells, all these kind of things.
And also,
there's really
the
nothing
fact,
like,
so that would be super cool, but it almost is meaningless without some, like, imagery to support what you're seeing on the charts. And that's what's so cool about this story, is that this entire swell was cataloged by a now very famous surf photographer by the name of Scotty Bauer, who at the time was just 24 years old. He wasn't really properly a photographer. He just happened to be, you know, interested in it, and he had a film camera and he was around. And so he captured all this incredible imagery from this swell, which is included in this story. And he said that that's actually what made him want to and believe he could be a surf photographer. He had one roll of film that he shot, which an old roll of film, at least this type, used to have 36 shots on it. And he said he has 4 career photos on that one roll of film, which at the time, like, he didn't even know. Like, he would, you know, he'd take them and he'd have to go home and ship them off and wouldn't get them for weeks at a time. So this was all happening and nobody really knew the, you know, the momentousness, that doesn't really sound like a word, but of the moment and
momentum generation.
Yes, exactly. So it's just, it's a really, really cool sort of nostalgic reverie of a moment in time that I think every surfer would hope to have something like this happen to them at some point. And these people happened to be lucky enough for it to happen, and they captured it all. Ben Mondi did a great job writing the story. And there were a few other people there that whose names you might know, such as Dave McCauley, who happens to be the dad of Bronte McCauley, who was also there with him, along with Jack Robinson and Jacob Wilcox. So they were obviously very little kids at the time, but the fact that they were there and just, like, you know, absorbing it in some form, I would imagine had a big impact on the way that their lives have turned out and the waves that they like to surf today.
Iconic, Mikey. Iconic. The Stab interview with Christopher Chippa Wilson. This one was done by Garrett James. It was conducted in the fine nation of Japan, which, as we mentioned...
Oh, that would make his name James Garrett.
James Garrett. This was the interview with Wilson Christopher, which still kind of works, by James Garrett, the fine nation of Japan, which will be hosting the next High Stab, as we've discussed on week last's episode. Mikey,
we're
going to hear some of this, aren't we?
We're going to hear some of this, and which actually goes straight into one of the most interesting things and the first things that you're going to read in this interview, which is Chippa used to not like speaking because he had a really severe lisp and he got bullied about it by the surfers on the Gold Coast, which made him basically never want to go up there and sort of hate everything about that, like, jockey sponsory culture, which is probably why he ended up not getting a proper sponsor till he was 21 years old. But yeah, it's basically his career has taken such a different path to almost any surfer that you've ever known. And that's what this interview really drills down into.
Which that is right in the beginning. And I found that wild because, like, especially growing up, like, kind of far from it, you always, and then visiting, you kind of get this feeling that, like, the Gold Coast is really where, like, the friendliest, kindest surfers are. Like, you hear those classic stories about, like, people even being out at night and seeing, like, a mosquito on somebody's head and trying to get it with, like, a glass bottle, just trying to help somebody else out. And so the fact that they were mean to him was really surprising to me. I like learning that we learn about his nickname by the end. That's where we start. And then we learn about his nickname, that it came from an American sitcom. He was Salty Crew from day one, not a savory boy. Not only this sitcom gave him this third child named Chip, but also he loved chips. So I learned a lot here. Learned a lot about that trip with Phil. And I'm not sure what exactly segment we're going to pull from here, but should we hear him?
Yeah, let's hear him.
What about this Pacific Island trip? What were you guys doing in I guess, what was the original plan like?
Yeah, for the film, like? Yeah, the plan was to go to the East Coast, like around my hometown, Cabarita, and south of that, down like Lenox and Yamba and a few spots like that, to do like an Aussie trip with the Monster Energy Australian lads, Dion and Harry. I actually land in Sydney and jump in a 80 series Toyota with my mate Jacko, who was filming that section. And as soon as we got in the car, it was torrential rain, like so gnarly, like wet. And we had an eight-hour drive, and we get to the Byron Bay kind of region. it didn't let up for like a week, and we were trying to film. Jacko flooded one camera, trying to film. Like, it was just, it just wasn't working out, you know what I mean? So we pretty much binned it. We were like, fuck it. I guess we may put in 30 seconds of footage, maybe, just for the boys, like for Dee and Haz to be involved, because they're my homies and they're on the team. And we're like fucking tripping. So we went out and partied super hard just because we were bummed. Like, what else are you going to do? We went and drunk our sorrows away, you know what I mean? Midnight that night, get a text off Dave Fox. Boys, charts are looking good. We're heading off to a secret island. And we were just like, what? Like, we were done. We wrapped the film, you know what I mean? So the next morning, we got up early, completely just mutilated, hungover, jump on a flight, and end up somewhere, which was very terrifying. Yeah.
Yeah. So what did you guys rock into that first, right when you get there?
Yeah, so the flight was gnarly, so you kind of leave it at 8:30 Australian time, jump on a flight.
PM,
nighttime. Jump on a flight and you land at 3 a.m. in the morning in hung, so hung, like inoperable, like we're dusted. So then you got, 5 hours in the pitch black to like drive around in a little hatchback to, don't even know, like try to sleep upright in the little hatchie, you know what I mean? Like at the beach. And when the sun finally popped, it was this like left bodyboard slab with a bunch of boog lads there. They were doing like a magazine trip. So I was looking at it, I went, hell no, no, we're not doing that, you know what I mean? So we went and got some grub and caught it a day. Little did I know, the next day, we wake up, organize a charter boat to go to this wave, and we get down to the dock, and it is fucking chaos. There's a Chinese fishing vessel pretty much washed up on the highway. The docks ripping apart, yachts are sinking. It was just absolute, for me and Dion, like, there was water moving in a very safe spot, like, in a marina. There was boats going down. And I was looking at all, because I had a few friends from the Gold Coast who flew over just randomly, and Kale Walsh and shit were there too. And they were all big wave dudes, like, they chase it, you know what I mean? They looked at the charts and went, yeah, we're going, you know? I was looking at them just going, you lads good with this? Like, we're not even near the out there, you know what I mean? Like, fucking looks pretty serious, lads. And they were tripping. Yeah. So that's what I woke up to after like a pretty heavy hangover. Anxiety levels were through the roof.
Just straight into fucking pumping big surf after being...
Big surf, dude. And the videos that they showed me too of this wave was like, hell yeah, it was big, but it was perfect. So I was like, I'm down. If I can make the takeoff, I'm down. I was standing there and get drained, you know? But this swell was a little funky. It had a lot of west in it, and it was pretty much a deep water slab, probably about 8 to 10, with a blind close out coming at you. Like, you don't know what you're going to get, you know what I mean? And I kept just going to ones no one wanted. All the big wave dudes are like, probably calculated and know a little bit more than me, but I was just like, you're not going? I'm gonna run it. So I just fucking ate shit the whole time, but it was a good experience for me.
Was everybody running impact suits and all the fucking safety gear, and you guys are just fucking barebacking it?
There was a few lads out there with tech shit on. Yeah, I had like a comp octo leggy on, you know, I don't even know what you call them, but like a full comp leash on, twin fin with a little stabilizer in a 80s rocket out board. Like, I was a fucking clown out there. It was insane, but it was really cool to do it like that too.
Thank you as always for listening to The Drop. And yeah, another big week. I mean, Kelly Slater leaving competitive surfing, kind of, maybe. Like, it doesn't really get bigger than that, I suppose, as far as surf news goes. But here we are, and the Margaret River event is still going. At time of recording, it'll probably be ending in the next 24 hours or so, which means that Stace and I, or Stace and somebody, are due for a follow-up podcast. You can, of course, follow my bets online. They're at the bottom of every single comp wrap, which Tim Hawken has been writing and doing a great job at this week. I've really been enjoying those. Yeah, we bet on betonline.ag. That is our go-to gambling site for surf betting. And we're doing okay in Margaret's. We're ahead right now, but we need a couple of event winners to really drive this event home. So anyway, you can find all that. You know where it lives, stabmag.com. Again, if you are a listener, you can get 10% off a Stab Premium subscription by using the code DROPWALLETS. One word, plural. Go get some. And until next week, over and out.